All right, so this announcement I want to make for those who listen online as well. talking circles. You probably noticed after the election that our nation experienced some tumult, and you probably noticed that our community was no exception. We did as well. So here in our own community, though I hated to see it happen, it did happen that a few folks who voted left were feeling threatened by folks in the community who voted right, and they just quietly slipped away. And a few folks who voted right felt threatened by folks in the community who voted left, and they quietly slipped away as well. One of our stated values, you can find it on our website, is that we don't organize around a set of doctrines that we all agree to. No, we organize around a shared way of relating on the spiritual journey, and that is that we respect one another where we are on the journey, and we don't impose on one another what that journey should look like at any point along the way. Well, if we can do that on the spiritual journey, it occurs to me, and my hope is, that we can learn to do that together through this political and social firestorm that's kind of going on in our national life. One thing of note has been that folks on the left have been a little more vocal in this particular firestorm. I think that's kind of true nationally. I know it has been true in our community. But consequently, several folks on the right have felt unwelcomed at NRCC. So the group that I formed immediately after the election to kind of think about how we're going to navigate our way through this and stay connected to one another was pondering what to do about that, how to make right-ish folks feel welcome and respected at NRCC, and we quickly realized that that was the wrong question to ask. The better question was how to make everyone feel welcomed and respected, because the American church has also done a pretty good job in the past of making folks on the left feel unwelcomed and unrespected. So the question for the group was, how do we get to the place where everyone feels welcome? And so we decided that the first step in our response to the election is going to be to work through these talking circles. Circles are a way to have constructive and very difficult conversations in a way that everyone feels heard and respected and welcomed. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that a professor at Campbell Law School is going to help with the training for the facilitators of talking circles. And apologies to those who said they were interested and signed up. The group got really full really fast. And so those who expressed interest have to do the second round. But anyway, this group at Campbell Law uses this process to help families of murderers and families of murder victims speak to one another across that divide. And if a tool like this can work in that format, I suspect it could work for us as well to help us have tough conversations about politics and race and gender and so forth. As Christians, part of our mission is to be peacemakers, but you can't really get there by simply being nice. Playing nice isn't how we go about peacemaking. We have to learn how to be honest with one another, authentic, and learn how to love across the divide of our differences. Our differences aren't going away anytime soon. How do we love in that context? So as Christian, that is our mission. And also, there have been grave injustices that are going on in our society that have been thrust into our awareness as a nation lately. And another part of our Christian call is to heal what is broken in our world. Well, our ability to do that and to do that together kind of depends on our ability to be able to speak to one another across the divides. So we're starting with circles. Facilitators should be trained by April. We'll start having circles in May. I really do hope you'll participate. If you do, I think you will have a genuine sense of belonging here, no matter which side of which social divide you happen to fall on. And once we've done that and we've learned how to speak together, then we can get about the business that is really the business of the church to figure out how we can work together to repair a world that has been broken around us. So I would encourage you to participate with talking circles when you start to hear about them. All right? Pearlie, did I get everything? All right, very good. Okay, let's begin the lesson. We are well into this lesson, the title of which is Transcending a Religion of Fear. We started this lesson because you are no doubt aware there's a tremendous amount of fear going on in our lives these days. And in the lesson thus far, we have acknowledged how complex fear is, how it both keeps us alive and will kill us, how it will both motivate us and will immobilize us. And we've seen how we have to, almost as a necessity, develop interior strategies just to deal with how powerful fear is in our lives. We also have seen how religion, when it gets debased, becomes not much more than just one more psycho-emotional strategy for dealing with fear. But we saw the testimony of those who've gone before us is that religion can be so much more than that. When religion devolves into a coping strategy for fear, we are missing something profound, something wonderful, a fundamentally transformed relationship with fear. So there is recurring historical testament to this fundamental altering of our experience of fear, and it points us to the awakening to a deeper layer of consciousness, a deeper way of being human. In the earlier parts of this lesson, we called that the layer of spirit consciousness. So if you missed those introductory weeks of the lesson, I would encourage you to have a listen. And then last week, we moved from the introductory part of the lesson, and we began looking at the practical tools that have been left to us by our tradition to point us toward this altered experience of fear. One of which is to rise against the natural brain instincts that so easily control our lives. We have natural distraction strategies that tell us, don't look at that fear, because if you look at it, it will be so overwhelming and so daunting, you won't have the resources left over to get out there and kill the buffalo or gather the roots and the berries. And so our tradition says that strategy might work, but only for a short haul, only over the short run. So our tradition says we're going to need to do better to rise above those brain instincts that are repeatedly trying to distract us from fear, and instead we're going to go toward fear. We're going to sit with it. We're going to feel it, experience it, name it, acknowledge it. We looked at the Psalms of Lament last week. Because counterintuitively, going toward our fear actually turns out to be one of the ways in which we experience that transformed relationship with fear. So we're encouraged in our tradition to step back from our brain strategies that are trying their best to keep us from being overwhelmed by fear and to look at how we can do better. Well, one of the brain strategies that we began to look at last week was the tendency that our brains give us that when we are confronted by fear, by tragedy, which produces the fear of tragedy, or heartache that produces the fear of heartache, or struggle or suffering that produces the fear of struggle and suffering, our answer is to that pain and to that suffering and into that fear that they create to seek a dose of comfort. A squirt of brain pleasure chemicals to give us a sense of well-being. So we've been knocked out of equilibrium by our fear and its powerful force in our lives, and we bring about some equilibrium by seeking some comfort or by seeking some pleasure. Without thinking, pretty soon, that devolves into habit. And we begin to be mindless in the pursuit of comfort. We begin to be mindless in the pursuit of pleasure. We reach for something pleasurable as soon as the beginning feelings of fear show up. Sometimes they don't even surface as fear. Sometimes they show up as boredom. Sometimes they show up as anxiety, but sometimes they show up as just an interior sense of malaise. But when it shows up, the roots of it being in fear, we have this automatic tendency to reach for something pleasurable in order to balance out our bad feelings by creating some good ones. But again, we saw that strategy really only works in the short run, because in the long run, it lulls us into a reality that isn't real. We live in a pretend world, acting as though fear is not there, that for all of our self-soothing and for all of our self-distracting, it nevertheless is. It is there. We also saw that our tradition gives us a set of practices to help us not get lulled into this false sense, to not get lulled into habitual dependence on comfort and pleasure to balance out our interior worlds, and to not get distracted from what's actually going on in our interior worlds. And again, if you missed last week, I'd encourage you to have listened to that as well. Well, today I want to talk about a second coping strategy that our brains deploy. It's the coping strategy of righteous indignation. You might have noticed that around as well of late. I was listening to a podcast recently, and the interviewee was talking about how brand new social media is, and how immature it is as a technology, and how immature it is as a force shaping our society, because it is surely shaping our society, but as a technology itself, it is young. And so it's suffering the pain of adolescence, the growing pains that come with it. Right now, the interviewee said, there are about 50 young males who are writing code that is affecting the way that 2 billion people on the earth are living. And they make small technological decisions like how big a text box should be or how many characters should be allowed. And in those small decisions affect profoundly how we behave. They changed the size of a box in a blogging platform and noticed that about 17 million people changed the length of their blog posts, which changed how well they developed their arguments, which changed what happened in the comment sections afterwards, which profoundly changed social discourse by just some guy deciding that text box should be slightly bigger. And so with all of these people making these decisions profoundly affecting so many people, we are doing that at a time in which we are still living with a very immature technology. Well, one of the orienting principles of the algorithms that get written around social media is, it seems to be a very good principle on the face of it. It is to try their best to give you and I what we want. One of the orienting principles is to give us what we want. And that seems great until the unintended consequences of giving us what we want show up, because what it turns out that we want is we want to be tribal. We want to talk to people, and we want to be with people, and we want to interact with people who are our people. And in the effort to give us what we want, TV has tailored news outlets to allow us to get our news from people who agree with our social and with our political views. And the algorithms that define how our social network news feeds go are designed to hide views that we don't agree with and to move up and make more prominent views that we do agree with. Our tribal instincts make us want to be around people who think the same way that we think. And these algorithms are trying their best to give us what we want. And so consequently, we want to be around people who will enforce the rightness of our views. We want to be around people who are telling us that our way of thinking is the right way of thinking. In fact, it's the only sensible way of thinking that there is. In fact, it is the way that God thinks. And in fact, it is the one and holy and righteous way of thinking. And by surrounding ourselves with people who think our own thoughts, and having them reinforce those thoughts back to us, is very easy to develop a case of groupthink, which is easy because groupthink feels good. Groupthink is pleasurable. When we are involved in groupthink, we feel like we are connected to something that is larger than ourselves. It helps us feel safe because we are surrounded by our tribe. It distracts us from our interior fears because we're surrounded by our tribe. Well, there's a problem with that that was discerned by our spiritual forebears long before this hyperpolarized moment in history. They saw very early on how easily it is to be distracted from feeling our fears by being around people who are reinforcing our own perspectives on the way things are, and how effective it can be as a fear coping strategy, but how limiting it can be in terms of moving forward on the spiritual journey. Listen to what Jesus had to say about that. Large groups of people were walking with Jesus, and he said to them, "You really want to come with me? You're going to have to let go of your father, your mother, your spouse, and your children, your brothers and sisters. You'll even have to let go of yourself. To walk this path, you have to let go of everything you once held dear. Absent that, you can't really get there from here." Now, we looked at that text last year and said then that it's pretty unlikely, given other things that he taught, that what Jesus was espousing here was a brand new virtue of family hating. That was probably not what he was after. More likely, what he was doing was challenging the power of groupthink to control us. Because what groupthink does is it acts like a black hole, and it sucks people of the same family and of the same culture and of the same religious view, the same political view. It sucks us all into shared thoughts and shared feelings, and then, without us noticing that it happens, uses those shared thoughts and feelings to then begin and control us and keep us locked from moving into new insights and new understandings. So Jesus warned us that if we become too attached to our group's ideas, the religious ideas of our groups, the political ideas, the philosophical ideas of a group, if we get overly attached to our beliefs, we're going to narrow our focus to the one and true thing that our group tells us truth is. Before we know it, we've cut ourselves off from the more expanded version of reality, because there is no one perspective that can contain the full truth. We've seen that as we've been studying the ineffability of God. There's no thought that you can think that can contain God. There is no word that you can say. There's no text that you can write that can contain the enormity of the divine or any of the aspects that we call the spiritual life. They can't be contained in thoughts. That's the word transcendence in our tradition. So no one perspective can ever contain the fullness of truth, and that's true of our religious views. But it's also true of our political views, our cultural views, our social views. None can contain the whole picture. So once we begin getting caught in groupthink and closing our eyes to other truths, it's not long before our field of vision and really our mental bandwidth gets narrowed. And it's not long after that before we begin to see the faultiness of those outside of our group. And it's not long after that that those outside of our group are not only faulty, they're bad, or they're morally inferior. And oops, before we see it, prejudice has just crept right in. And it happens so naturally because that's how our brains are wired. That's what happens in the way that our neurons work. It happens so smoothly that we don't even realize that we've fallen into a distraction strategy designed to keep our fears under control. Any time that we get worked up about the righteousness of our cause, it would serve us well to hold back just a little bit of suspicion, a little bit of suspicion that some of what's going on might be an interior distraction strategy to keep us from feeling our fears. Because again, it feels good to generate negative emotions toward bad people. It's energizing. It feels good to generate positive feelings toward good people. That feels energizing. And whenever we feel good, we have fallen into the possibility of using that as a strategy to balance out the negative feelings that are generated by fear. And while we're doing that, feeling all that goodness, it's convenient to ignore the possibility that our categories of good and bad might not be fully informed. It's convenient to ignore the possibility that our categories of good and bad might be missing the bigger picture. But we do it, again, because that energy that gets created when we use these distraction strategies, there's a tidiness to the distraction there's energy related with the distraction. But ironically, when we've seen something that needs repairing in the world, when we get sucked into this strategy, actually changing the broken thing in the world that made us indignant in the first place gets infinitely harder, because now we've removed ourselves from the broader picture and the complexity that is going to be demanded of the change dynamic. So this is not in my notes. I'm just going to throw this part in for free because Zach mentioned it after the first lesson. I asked you to listen to those the podcast from On Being, the collection called The Civil Conversations Project. And one was a person named Gushy, and the other one was named, anybody remember? Pardon? Francis, that's right. Gushy and Francis, their two last names. She's been working for 30 years pro-choice. He's been working for 30 years pro-life. And so for 30 years, they have focused on Roe v. Wade, and they have worked on changing the legality of that, changing hearts and minds. And they said, both of them, after 30 years, we have thrown our life into that. 30 years is a long time, and nothing has changed. We are still right where we were in 1973. So they said, 2 years ago, we tried doing something else. We thought we'd try another strategy. We sat down, and we tried to understand each other. We sat down, and we tried to talk to each other. And all of a sudden, we realized that we weren't even trying to solve the problem. We were trying to solve what we thought was the problem. We didn't solve the problem. So the person on the right said, if we get what we want, if we overturn Roe v. Wade, we've got to understand that all these things that we are also defunding, there's going to be a whole lot of babies that are going to be born, and we are not prepared for that. We might not like what we get if we get this. And she said, after 30 years of fighting for pro-choice, we have not even slightly begun to pay attention to how grave a thing, how serious it is to make a baby. We've got to pay attention. This is not some small thing. This is enormous. This is at the very core of life. And now we understand the problem. Now, neither one of them changed their perspective. Neither one have come and said, I've completely changed. But now they know what they're trying to change. Now they know what they're trying to work at. So when we limit ourselves down to the group speak, we don't even understand the problem that needs to be resolved. And that happens to us. And it's very energizing when it does. So I grabbed this story from a book. And I don't know what book it came from because I lost the title. So my apologies to the author, whoever the author is. But it's a story of two inmates who were living on death row. And they can both see a television, and one of them has no volume on his television. And so, says the one with volume, hey, look at channel 7. And so the one with no volume looked up, and he said, yep, there's a bunch of angry people waving their arms. So he calls down the aisle, calls down the hallway, what are they so upset about? And the guy responds back, that's the Klan, and they're upset about how bad black people and Jewish people are. And a while later, the guy calls down the hallway again and says, hey, look what's happening now. And the man with the volume down raises his eyes again. And this time he sees a group of people marching with placards. And he says, who are they and what are they so angry about? And he says, well, those are environmentalists, and they're upset about people who are cutting down trees and people who are killing seals. And then 10 minutes later, you still watching? And he says, yeah, I am. And he looks up and he says, what are those guys up? What's up with them? And they said, well, they're all senators, and they're blaming each other for screwing up the economy. And this is the part that I wrote down from the story. He said, well, Omar, I learned something tonight. Whether they're wearing Klan outfits or environmentalist outfits or expensive suits, everybody has the same angry face. We get so easily sucked into the trap of righteous indignation because it's powerful. And we get so easily sucked into the trap of righteous indignation because the thing that we're indignant about often is reasonable. We see an important part of truth, and we see it clearly, and our group sees it clearly, and we get really upset that everybody doesn't see it as clearly as we do, as our group sees it. But then there's another part of us that likes being in the seeing group. We like being the morally superior ones. We like being the righteous ones. We like being the ones who can see clearly. So it actually almost works in our favor from a distraction strategy perspective to have a group of people out there as a foil that we can operate in contrast to. So it's an easy trap to fall into because there is often in our righteous indignation a seed of righteousness. But when we use our righteous indignation as a strategy to distract us from fear, just like we saw last week with comfort and pleasure, we put ourselves into a pretend world. And when we do that, when we live in a world that isn't real, we deceive ourselves, we weaken ourselves, and we end up blunting our effectiveness. So, all of that background for this question. Are you feeling a little righteous indignation these days? If you are, it doesn't mean that the thing that you're indignant about isn't righteous. There's a good chance it is. Some part of it probably is, because we're not stupid. We see something, and we see something real, and we see something important, and we see something that's true. But if you're feeling righteous indignation these days, it might not mean that you aren't missing the point. It might not mean that there is a bigger picture that contains the truer or the truest true. And in all likelihood, just the fact that we're feeling righteous indignation might be veering us off from the capacity to see clearly. That's what happens when we get caught up in distraction strategies. That's what happens when the things that make us feel good are being used unconsciously to help us not have to feel bad. So with the sound turned off and with the settledness of someone with nothing left to lose, a death row inmate is able to see that even when we serve a righteous cause, it can be easy to miss the point. Even when we serve a righteous cause, it can be easy to fall into judgment or self-righteousness or condemnation. It can be easy for our faces to show hate. It can be easy for our hearts to become poisoned. It can be easy for us to stop listening and stop understanding. It can be more important to be understood than it is to understand, going directly in the face of what the Francis Prayer taught us to pray. There's a very good chance that if we're using righteous indignation as a distraction strategy, that strategy will betray us. So again, ask the question, has indignation captured you recently? It's captured a whole lot of people. Are you feeling indignant toward those who have different views? Maybe they are homophobic, or maybe they are homophilic, or maybe they are pro-women's rights, or maybe they are anti-women's rights, or maybe they are pro-environment, or maybe they are anti-environment, maybe they are pro-immigrants, or maybe they are anti-immigrants, maybe they are pro-Christian, or maybe they are anti-Christian. And ask if there is a place in which you are deeply identified with an ism. And if you find yourself deeply identified with an ism, our tradition's suggestion is to explore that and to ask if you are unwittingly using that ism to cover a fear, using that ism and the energy, the profound energy that it generates, to cope with fear. Are we using it to distract us from those primal fears instead of feeling them? Because again, as we said last week, our tradition says if we want to get to that transformed experience of fear, you're going to have to feel it. You're going to have to sit with it. You're going to have to stop doing the things that our brains automatically do to us to help us manage it, cope with it, and avoid it. So, if you notice that you have become overly identified with any group's cause, a good question to ask is that helping me not have to feel my fear? If you've become overly identified with any group's cause, is that helping you feel safe or noble? Because if you feel safe and you feel noble, you don't have to feel those things that we don't want to. A good question to help us examine ourselves is, how are we handling the people who think differently than we do these days? Are we thriving on the energy that dissonance creates inside of us? Are we overly savoring our feelings of rightness? Are we overly savoring the energy that gets stirred up when we focus on our adversary's wrongness? Or are we using righteous indignation so that we don't have to sit with our fears? Because if we are, we are ignoring the wisdom of our tradition to go toward our fear and to feel it and to be with it. It's very difficult to discern the bigger picture when we're caught up. It's unlikely that we ever will discern the bigger picture if we don't do the work that our tradition invites us to of feeling and pushing back against our distraction habits. If we continue to let those habits divert our attentions and to avoid the unpleasantness of our fear, there's a good chance we won't see clearly. So this week, we begin Lent. And Lent is an annual reminder to take up some practice to challenge an inner habit that is working against our well-being. Last week, we talked about the habitual, mindless habits of reaching for comfort or reaching for pleasure. This week, we are talking about the interior habit of righteous indignation. Both are strategies for avoiding our fear. Same strategy, avoidance. We savor the feelings of in-grouping. We savor the feelings of out-grouping. We feel the righteousness of our cause so we can avoid our fears. So perhaps this Lent, you might take up a practice to challenge whichever strategy is a greater temptation to you. Maybe you could challenge your dependence on pleasure at some point. Challenge and push up against the habits, the mindless habits, of pursuing comfort. Or maybe you could challenge mindlessness as a habit, the thoughtlessness that goes into our reactionary responses. Now, sometimes we challenge mindlessness of our habits. We challenge our dependence on comfort and pleasure by doing what you've commonly heard during the season of Lent, give up some favorite thing, maybe chocolate, maybe coffee. Coffee, who would give that up? Perish the thought. What kind of knucklehead would do that? But the point of giving those things up is to bring ourselves to alertness to what is typically mindless. What are we looking toward? What are we seeing? And by giving that up and on a regular basis feeling the temptation to go back to that favorite thing, we're actually challenging our dependence upon distraction. The point is to be alive. The point is to be alert. The point is to be attentive. The point is to be mindful, to see the reality that is going on inside of us. And often that reality is fear. Often that reality are the bad feelings, the uncomfortable feelings that go with fear. Or maybe this Lent you would explore righteous indignation. And perhaps our tradition has given us some direction there as well. If righteous indignation is your temptation, is the strategy that you are using in order to not feel your negative feelings, you could do what our tradition has also taught us to do, go serve some part of the world that is broken, only choose a part of the world about which you are not indignant. Go serve in some area for the purpose of serving when you are not feeling the righteousness of that cause. And in so doing, to challenge the energy that comes with indignation, the dependence upon that energy that flows from our indignation, and to challenge the habit and to challenge the self-righteousness and to challenge the groupthink and to challenge the temptation to in-group some people and out-group other people, challenge that by serving in an area that is not your cause. Or maybe this Lent, you could take up the practice of being faithful to meditative practices. Faithful attentiveness to your breath, because when you're paying attention to your breath, you are paying attention to what is. And it's not long after you are paying attention to what is that you can also pay attention to what is when we are afraid. There's a particular kind of meditation that you might want to use if that is your issue, and that is called body scan meditation. If you go to YouTube and you just put in body scan meditation, you can find ones that are 5 minutes long and ones that are 45 minutes long. but it's basically to go and make sure you are attentive to what's happening in your feet, attentive to what's happening in your ankles, attentive to what's happening in your legs, attentive to what's happening in your knees, and just go through your body and do a scan, being attentive to what is. Because if we can sense our sensations, if we can feel our feelings, if we can watch what is going on and be alert to and accepting of the unvarnished, undistracted realities that we carry inside of ourselves, we are actually pushing up against the mindless habit of distracting ourselves from our fears. And this, our tradition tells us, is one of the ways that we experience this fundamentally altered relationship with fear, this fundamentally transformed experience of fear. So, this Lent, perhaps yours would be a practice of disengagement, disengaging from comfort or pleasure, disengaging from mindlessness. Or perhaps it would be a discipline, a practice of engagement, serving in an area outside of your righteous indignation, engaging mindfulness practice, watching your thoughts, feeling your feelings. Because mindlessness actually becomes our adversary. Habit becomes our adversary. Mindless habits, chasing comfort or pleasure, mindless attachment to righteous indignation, mindlessness of any kind reduces us, lowers us by distracting us. Mindless habit traps us in a reality that's not real. Mindless habit enslaves us to a reduced version of being human. It roots us in pretend lives, all so that we don't have to feel the unpleasantness of our fears. So it's a costly strategy, mindlessness. It costs us the promise of our tradition to be one with the divine, to be baptized in, filled with the Holy Spirit. It costs us that on the promise of our tradition that on the other side of our fears, there's a transformed experience of them, an altered relationship with them. So I encourage you to take some time before Wednesday and look for a practice that helps you not live a distracted life, to help you feel what is, to see what is, to be present to what is. I mentioned a couple of possibilities this time. If you haven't found something by next week, it won't be too late. I'll suggest some more. So you, if you're looking for a practice that will help you challenge your temptation, the menu will get larger next week. By the way, the thing that I mentioned earlier about Jennifer doing this welcoming prayer module during Lent, that is really helpful because what it does is it brings mindfulness to our everyday moments. When you're at work, when you're working on the computer, when you're driving somewhere in the car, you can bring mindless. I would really encourage you to participate in her Wednesday module. So Holy Spirit, to be alert to what is real, to be alive to what is, to be non-avoiding, and to not fall prey to our brain habits at the expense of our long-term well-being. Be it so in us, Lord, be it so among us. In Jesus' name, amen.